content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Greg Cockcroft from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is The Atlantic. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from The Atlantic magazine. We will begin with I, Sly. Sly Stone Tells His Story by James Parker. Is there a way to look at Sly Stone, a musical genius and, for a couple of years, an avatar of spiritual freedom that isn't dualistic, split-brained, one thing in opposition to another? That isn't about light versus darkness, up versus down, logos versus chaos, good drugs versus bad drugs, having it all versus losing it all, and on and on. Without contraries is no progression, William Blake said. But still, I find myself groping for another plane of understanding. I want to see him as the angels do. We might need to evolve a little bit to get a handle on this man. To the binary American eye, certainly, he soared and then he smashed. Sly Stone held the 60s in the palm of his hand. He had the plumage and vibration of Jimi Hendrix, and the melodic instinct of Paul McCartney. His music married ballooning hippie consciousness to the tautest and worldliest and most street-facing funk. Its end product, its neurochemical payload, was an amazing, paradoxically wised-up euphoria, a rapture peddled with knowingness, with slyness. Live, he could bend time to his will like James Brown. His band, Sly and the Family Stone, polyracial, polygendered, polyfreaking-phonic, you could never quite tell which voice was Sly's, and he himself had several, was a crucible of joy, a crucible of possibility, an experiment that took people on the character of a proof. People could live together. America could work. Love and justice were real. For about a minute. I can't imagine my life without Sly Stone, Cornel West said in the 2017 documentary On the Sly in Search of the Family Stone. Sly created a music that became a place where we could go to have a foretaste of that freedom, of that democratic experience, even though we couldn't live it on the ground. And by 1975, it was essentially over. His creativity squandered, his reputation in tatters, cocaine and PCP and paranoia everywhere. Decades of obscurity followed, punctuated by occasional failed resurrections. Plenty of people, upon hearing about his new memoir, Thank You for Letting Me Be Myself Again, written by Ben Greenman, will be surprised to learn that he is still alive. But Sly lives, and the resourceful Greenman, whose publishing credits include the co-writing of a memoir by George Clinton, has coaxed, wheedled, massaged, used God knows what process of titration and palpitation to extract a fascinating book from him. I have some questions, not too many, he tells his subject in the moody snippet of transcribed conversation that prefaces Thank You. We don't have to do them all. We don't have to do any of them at all, answers Sly. Pretty much the definition of an unreliable narrator, Sly nonetheless has some clear memories. Young Sly at home in Vallejo, California, watches the Cowboys on TV. I liked Roy Rogers and Gene Autry. My favorite was Lash LaRue. There was no one cooler. He wore all black and he used a whip. Middle school's church-going Sly is mesmerized by the high-energy soul singers, Sam Cooke, Jackie Wilson, who came out of gospel. They kept what was holy and added in what was earthy. I wanted to sing like them, control the stage like them. Student Sly at the Vallejo Junior College has a great teacher, Mr. Froelich, who explains music theory to him with vision-inducing clarity. I could see the melodic lines, watch them intertwine. It's wrong to say that it was like shoelaces, but it's also wrong to say that it wasn't at least a little like that. He also has some memory holes or some places he'd rather not go. Drugs came in. There were reasons. I was trying to write, trying to play, trying to record. All of that needed to be fueled. But how did the fuel make me feel? A drug is a substance, and so is the question. The question has substance. A drug can be temporary, escape, and so I will temporarily escape that question. Career-building Sly was a radio DJ in San Francisco, honing his patter, and also a record producer, bedding down in the acid wisps of Haight Ashbury, tweaking the beat music of the Beau Brummels, tuning up the thumping psych pop of the Mojo Men, cracking the whip like Lash LaRue. The family stone, he tells Ben Greenman, was a concept. White and black together, male and female both, and women not just singing, but playing instruments. That was a big deal back then, and it was a big deal on purpose. Woodstock was a peak. Just past 4 a.m, Sly and the Family Stone played I Want to Take You Higher, and Sly initiated a call-and-response routine that was like heaven talking to earth. Just say higher and throw the peace sign up, he exhorted the rained-on, worn-out, crawling around in its sleeping bag crowd. It'll do you no harm. From the darkness came the answer, thousand-voiced, in a wall of affirmation. Higher! After Woodstock, Sly remembers in Thank You, everything glowed. Entropy was already at work. As beautifully as he had realized and organized the Family Stone, Sly was also an arch orchestrator of turmoil, the control of no control, endless brinksmanship. Would he show up for the gig or not? And in what condition? Pitched his band into despair. There was a devouring out-of-it appearance on the Dick Cavett Show. Gangsterhood enveloped his household. Guns, drugs, sketchy people. At the center of Thank You, like a gyre of disruption, is the image of Sly's as-good-as feral pit bull gun whirling around in pursuit of his own tail. He was my best friend. He was crazy. He would chase his tail in circles, not for a minute or for an hour, but forever. Gun ends up mauling Sly's toddler son, Sylvester Stewart, Jr. For some people, there's a riot going on. Sly's itchy, woozy, drum machine bummer of a 1971 album is a masterpiece. For me, the drug vibes are too heavy, the flashes of self-awareness too sour and fleeting, the music too much like Gun chasing his own tail. It was certainly groundbreaking, through the crust and downward. The two albums that followed it, Fresh, 1973, and the insufficiently listened to Small Talk, 1974, were probably better records, better art, but with Riot, Sly had cast a long evil spell on himself and his audience. The Family Stone was falling apart, a disastrous showcase at Radio City Music Hall in January of 1974 had the smell of the end. So what is it? The Sly Stone story? Utopia colliding with reality? Not that, because Sly was his own kind of realist all along. The slow death of the 60s? Not that either. The 60s were about conflict, and conflict, as far as we can tell, never dies. The space created by Sly and the Family Stone, the blast radius of delight, that too will never die. Genius undone by addiction, then? Is that it? Too small, way too small. Look on him, rather, as a supreme artist, elected and condemned to expand actuality and thereby to experience himself fully and on the grandest scale. His flaws, writ large, his glory, almost dazzling, all simultaneously, all one. Next, Nixon Between the Lines by Andrew Ferguson. Call it coincidence, serendipity, an aligning of the planets, whatever the term, the moment was creepy and amusing all at once. I was beavering away in the basement research room at the Richard Nixon Presidential Library and Museum in Yorba Linda, a suburb of Los Angeles, when Henry Kissinger twice came into view. In the flat, cursive form of Nixon's scrawl in the margins of the book I was reading, and then in the rounder, corporeal form of the man himself in the hallway outside the door. Kissinger, the last surviving member of Nixon's cabinet, was in Yorba Linda last fall for two reasons: to speak at a fundraising gala for the Richard Nixon Foundation, and to promote a book he had published earlier in the year at the improbable age of 99. The book, entitled Leadership, contains an entire chapter in praise of Nixon, the man who had made Kissinger the 20th century's only celebrity diplomat. I was there to gather material for a Nixon book of my own. I had been nosing around in the cache of volumes from Nixon's personal library. I was particularly interested in any marks he may have left in the books he'd owned. From what I could tell, no one had yet mined this remarkably varied collection, more than 2,000 books filling roughly 160 boxes stored in a vault beneath the Presidential Museum. Taken together, they reflect the broad range of Nixon's intellectual curiosity and underappreciated quality of his highly active mind. To give an idea, one heavily underlined book in the collection is a lengthy biography of Tolstoy. Another is a book on statesmanship by Charles de Gaulle. Another is a deep dive into the historiography of Japanese art. Several fat volumes of The Story of Civilization, Will and Ariel Durant's mid-century monument to Middlebrow history, display evidence of attentive reading and rereading. Every morning a friendly factotum would wheel out a gray metal cart stacked with dusty boxes from Nixon's personal library. On the afternoon Kissinger arrived, I had worked my way down to an obscure book published in 1984, a decade after Nixon left the White House. A significant portion of Bad News, the Foreign Policy of the New York Times, by a foreign correspondent for the New York Daily News named Russ Braley, is a blistering indictment of the Times' coverage of the Nixon administration. In Braley's telling, the Times' treatment swung between the unfair and the uncomprehending, for reasons ranging from negligence to malice. The book had found its ideal reader in Richard Nixon. The pages of his copy were cluttered with underlining from his thick ballpoint pen. It occurred to me as I followed along that Nixon was being brought up short by his reading. Much of the material in Bad News was apparently news to him. My reading was interrupted by a commotion outside the research room. I stuck my head out in time to see Kissinger and his entourage settling into a room across the hall. A group of donors and Nixonophiles had gathered to hear heroic tales of Nixon's statecraft. I dutifully returned to Braley. When I got to the chapter on Daniel Ellsberg and the Pentagon Papers, I found an unmistakable pattern. Most of Nixon's markings involved the man holding court across the hall, and Nixon wasn't happy with him. Kissinger, Braley wrote, had actually invited Ellsberg to Nixon's transition office in late 1968 to explicate his dovish views on Vietnam more than 2 years before the papers were released. Nixon's pen came down, exclamation point. Kissinger gave Ellsberg an office in the White House complex anyway, for a month in 1969, a stone's throw from the Oval Office. Slash mark. Kissinger spent his evenings ridiculing Nixon in private conversations with liberal friends. This last treachery summoned the full battery of Nixon's marginalia, a slash running alongside a paragraph, a check mark for emphasis, and a plump, emphatic line under liberal friends. Still, Braley went on, and when the Pentagon Papers were leaked, their publication alarmed Kissinger because they posed a double threat to national security and to the conduct of foreign policy. And to Kay, Nixon wrote in the margin. The contrast between Nixon's bitter hash marks about Kissinger from the 1980s and Kissinger's present-day celebration of his old boss offered a lesson in evolving calculation of self-interest. It also conjured the image of a solitary old man in semi-retirement, learning things about a now-vanished world he once thought he presided over. It happened often in the reading room in Yorba Linda. With unexpected immediacy, the gray metal cart carried the past into the present in small but tangible fragments of Nixon himself. The task of a marginalia maven is at right angles to the task of reading a book. It is an attempt to read the reader rather than to read the writer. For several decades now, scholars have been swarming the margins of books in dead people's libraries. Famous readers whose libraries have fallen under such scrutiny include Melville and Montague, Machiavelli, and Mark Twain. A book invites various kinds of engagement, depending on the reader. Voltaire, whom Nixon admired to judge by his extravagant underlining in the Durrants, The Age of Voltaire, scribbled commentary so incessantly that his marginalia have been published in volumes of their own. Voltaire liked to argue with a book. Nixon did not. He had a lively mind, but not, when reading, a disputatious one. He restricted his marginalia almost exclusively to underlining sentences or making other subverbal marks on the page, boxes and brackets and circles. You get the idea that he knew what he wanted from a book and went searching for it. And when he found what he wanted, he pinned it to the page with his pen. Seldom, from what I've seen, a pencil. In his method, Nixon resembled the English writer Paul Johnson. I once asked Johnson how, given his prolific journalistic career, several columns and reviews a week in British and American publications, how he managed to read all the books he cited in his own very long and very readable histories, which embrace such expansive subjects as Christianity, ancient Egypt, and the British Empire. His reaction bordered on revulsion at my naivete. "Read them," he spat out. "Read them. I don't read them. I fillet them." As it happens, Nixon was an avid reader of Johnson, whose books he often handed out to friends and staff at Christmas time. John Adams, another busy producer of marginalia, liked to quote a Latin epigram, "Studium sine calamo somnium." Adams translated this as, "Study without a pen in your hand is but a dream." Nixon acquired the pen-in-hand habit early, as his surviving college and high school textbooks show, and he kept it at it throughout his life. For Nixon, as for the rest of us, marking up books was also a way of slowing himself down and attending to what he had read. He was not a notably fast reader, by his own account, but his powers of concentration and memorization are considerable. Going at a book physically was a way of absorbing it mentally. One of the most heavily represented authors in Nixon's personal library is Churchill, whom Nixon revered not only as a statesman, but also as a historian and an essayist. Nixon's shelves sagged with Churchill's multi-volume histories and biographies, The World Crisis, Marlborough, His Life and Times, The Second World War, A Short History of the English-Speaking Peoples. Churchill's great contemporaries, a series of sketches he wrote in the 1920s and 30s, sizing up roughly two dozen friends and colleagues, was clearly a favorite. When I retrieved Nixon's copy from a box, I found it dog-eared throughout. The book I most wanted to see in Yorba Linda was Nixon's copy of Robert Blake's biography, Disraeli, 1966. A recreation of Nixon's favorite room in the White House was one of the Nixon Museum's prime exhibits when it opened in 1990, a few years before Nixon's death. Nixon himself chose Disraeli to rest on his desk for the public to see. The book was given to him during his first year in the White House in 1969 by Daniel Patrick Moynihan, the Harvard professor, prominent Democrat, and future U.S. Senator from New York. To the surprise of just about everybody, the year he took office, Nixon made Moynihan his chief domestic policy counselor, a counterpart in those early days to Kissinger as the head of the National Security Council. Despite Nixon's enduring image as a black-eyed right-winger, his political ideology was always flexible, if not flatly self-contradictory. Moynihan, the liberal, hoped to persuade Nixon, the hybrid, to take Benjamin Disraeli, the great prime minister of Victorian Britain, as his model. Disraeli was a Tory and an imperialist, and at the same time a social reformer of vision and courage. According to Moynihan, Nixon read the book within days of receiving it. Soon enough, the president was calling himself a Disraeli conservative. The precise meaning of the tag was clear to Nixon alone, but we can assume it underwent a great deal of improvisation and revision as his presidency wore on. Disraeli's appeal to Nixon went beyond his light-footed ideology. Speaking to his cabinet at a dinner one evening in early 1972, Nixon called Disraeli a magnificent politician. Now, he went on, the fashionable set today would immediately say, ah, politicians, bad. As he saw it, the fashionable set believe the politicians disdain idealism and think nothing of principle. But, Nixon said, the pages of history are full of idealists who never accomplished anything. It was pragmatic men like Disraeli who had the ability to do things that other people only talked about. Nixon, who had never shied away from calling himself a politician, wanted to see himself in Disraeli, or at least in Blake's Disraeli. This classic biography, to which he told his cabinet, he often turned for inspiration on sleepless nights. And here the book was, Nixon's own copy, at the top of my growing stack in Yorba Linda. Disraeli is packed with observations about political tradecraft. They are penetrating, specific, and cold-blooded. A little dicta comes from both the biographer and his subject. He was a master at disguising retreat as advance, Blake wrote approvingly. Nixon underlined that sentence, and then this one from Disraeli's contemporary Lord Salisbury. The commonest error in politics is sticking to the carcasses of dead policies. If you go looking for them, you can see reflections of Blake's Disraeli throughout Nixon's presidency, encapsulated in enduring phrases here and there. It was in Blake that Nixon came across Disraeli's famous description of exhausted volcanoes. Disraeli coined it to disparage the feckless time servers in William Ewart Gladstone's cabinet after they had been in office a few years. Nixon underscored not only exhausted volcanoes, but the rest of the passage from Blake's text. The phrase, Blake writes, was no mere jibe. From the past year, the government has been vexed by the combination of accidents, scandals, and blunders, which so often for no apparent reason seem to be set an energetic administration in its latter days. Nixon feared the same fate for his second term, a loss of energy and direction. The day after his landslide resignation in 1972, he called together his cabinet and senior staff. He told them about Disraeli's warning about exhausted volcanoes, and then, with his chief of staff, H.R. Haldeman, serving as the Lord High Executioner, he demanded their resignations en masse. Not everything in Blake's Disraeli caught Nixon's interest. Certainly not everything was useful to him. As I paged through, I saw there were many long years, stretches of several dozen pages, sometimes more, where no filleting of any kind happened, and then, inevitably, suddenly, Nixon, the reader, was seized by passages of sometimes thunderous resonance, and the pen is again called into play. Disraeli, Blake writes, really was regarded as an outsider by the Victorian governing class. One can almost see Nixon sit bolt upright and pick up his pen. This is why the same ostracism that Nixon himself felt keenly throughout his personal and professional life, in fact and in imagination. The following page and a half discussing the disdain of the elite for Disraeli is bracketed nearly in its entirety. Some sentences are boxed. Some passages, like this one, are underlined as well as bracketed. Men of genius operating in a parliamentary document. Democracy, inspired a great deal of dislike and no small degree of distrust among the bustling mediocrities who form the majority of mankind. The antagonism of the elites was not a determining fact of Disraeli's career, but both biographer and subject perceived its profound effects, and so did the man reading about it 90 years after Disraeli's death. But it may be that in 1969, sitting in the reading chair in his White House hideaway, Nixon already sensed that this was not bound to end well. An Ode to Being Yelled At by James Parker. To start with, you probably deserve it. Not for this, not for whatever it is you're being yelled at about, but for the other stuff. You know what I'm talking about. The innumerable tiny offenses. All the evasions, hedging, dodgings, half-assings, bloodless ill-doings accumulated in darkness. In the present moment, the present state of yelled atness, you may be the victim of a misunderstanding, an injustice even, but in general, yes, you should be denounced by the blow of a ram's horn and the beam of biblical light. Gongs of judgment should clash all around you, even if they're the wrong gongs. Everybody now and then needs to be yelled at. Let's go beyond morals. What about the rush? The eventful psychology of being yelled at. Your skin prickles, your armpits fizz. The lights of your limbic system are blinking on and off. Your amygdala is squawking like a car alarm. You're in a fascinating place. Look around. There may be treasures here, undiscovered images, poems wrapped in glittering around the brainstem. Then there's the yeller, the source of the noise. Can you appreciate their transformation, the changes they are going through? Before your eyes, a person is being magnified, rhetorically and physically inflated, pulsing with a wrathful radiance. You are seeing this person at twice their normal size. You are seeing them, in a way, in their splendor, and also their vulnerability, their preposterousness. Look at them quivering away. You've really set them off. Do they even know what they're saying? In my other gig as an editor, I get yelled at by writers, generally with complete justification. So I nod, I absorb, I mollify, etc. On one occasion, however, the yelling overwhelmed me. I took a slurp from the goblet of chaos and started yelling back, and like magic, it stopped. The universe of yelling was abruptly quieted. Some kind of elemental equalization had taken place. I felt like the great firefighter Red Adair, who used to extinguish flaming oil wells by literally blowing them out with a blast of high explosives. And then, post-yell, the world is altered. As in Ted Hughes' Wind After a Stormy Night, the hills had new places. You and the yeller may not forgive each other, but you know each other a little better. Next time, with luck and skill, you'll find a way not just to survive it, but to relish it. Is it difficult? Are you difficult? What if they're right? Open your ears, yelly, and take it. We've run out of time for today's episode of The Atlantic. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Greg Cockcroft, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The Atlantic is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. Have a great day.